Hi, welcome to the podcast. I am Joe Posnanski, and with me is Michael Shore. Michael, welcome.
Joe, thanks for having me.
You are welcome. You're welcome. You know, I want to start off this week's podcast, this week's exciting baseball-oriented podcast. Last week, we specifically, I believe we were pretty specific about this, specifically told people we didn't care if they rated this show.
That's right.
I thought we were pretty clear about that. But because there are readers, apparently some people rated it anyway, and which I would not know, except for somebody sent me one of the ratings, and I believe it should now be the slogan of the podcast. You know, I mean, it's something I think we've been looking for a slogan. We haven't, but this feels to me. Ed Fett put this in his rating, and I think this should be the slogan. Lowest information density of any podcast going today. I think Ed could not have nailed that any better. Would you agree?
Well, you know what's interesting about that is there is some information in the podcast. It's just that the podcast is so long that the density ends up being almost nil. It's like it's a small amount of information stretched out essentially to infinity.
Exactly.
So the key there is density.
It's the perfect word.
Yeah, it's not the low. It's like that year that Joe Carter had 100 RBIs, but he had like a negative WAR, or like Hanley Ramirez this year. You know, has like had 23 home runs and like, I don't know, 80 RBIs, but he had a negative offensive WAR because he hit fourth all year and was kind of terrible. So that's the key to that remark is it's not there's no information.
Right,
it's just
right.
The density of the information is essentially nil.
So I think it's fair. I think it's fair because of that. I think we probably, if we did this podcast, if this podcast lasted, I don't know, what do you say, 2.5 minutes,
yeah,
we would have about average information density for.
No,
for,
I think it would be very high density.
Oh, okay.
If it were 2.5
okay.
minutes.
Yeah.
I think if it lasted 23 minutes or something, it would have like average density.
I think
and instead it lasts like 84 minutes, and the density is at a microscopic. It's basically one atom thick of density spread out over 83 minutes.
Well done, Ed. Well done. I think we have our thing. All right, so. This bothers me that it's our last one, but it is time for our last Tommy Pham update.
It's the Tommy Pham update.
How did our guy Tommy Pham do? As the world's biggest fam is.
I'll tell you how Tommy Pham did. Tommy Pham had a 300, 400, 500 season. That's how Tommy Pham did. It was very exciting. It wasn't actually from the time we really started tracking it. I think he basically went over every line and stayed there. He never dipped down, or he did in the last like 2 weeks or 3 weeks of the season. He never dipped below any of those numbers. He closed strong.
Yes, he did.
I tweeted this the other day after the final game. I was waiting. He didn't play in the final game, and I was waiting until like the eighth or ninth inning to make sure that he didn't pinch hit and somehow go 0-for-8 in one pinch hit appearance. But 306, 411, 520, that's it. He had a 300, 400, 500 season. I tweeted out a GIF of fireworks.
Yes.
And it's very exciting. As newly minted famnas, it was very exciting. And he didn't quite get to the 25-25 season. I think he had 25 stolen bases, but only 23 homers, right? I think he ended at 23. But I mean, now here's the thing. Here's the real question. Do we track Tommy Pham throughout the entire 2018 season and see if he can repeat?
Well,
I think we do, right?
Well, it's an interesting question because I have thought about this. As Pham is, we certainly will have to track Tommy Pham. That said, I think that now he's done 300, 400, 500, which is obviously we'd like to call that the podcast stat. I think that is the stat of the podcast.
Sure.
We need somebody else to, we need to follow somebody else on that journey.
Yeah.
I think we just have to follow Tommy Pham, just because he will always be a powerful member of the podcast family.
Here's what I'm going to suggest. I'm going to suggest that hitting 300, 400, 500 for a season is now called the fam.
Ooh!
That's a fam.
That's a
fam. If you achieve that, it's like, congratulations, you've achieved a fam, right? So basically, Tommy Pham ascends into the sort of like all-timer sort of Hall of Fame of the podcast, and we find another person, and we see if that person can fam.
Exactly.
Maybe what we do is we each pick one guy before the season who we think can fam this in the 2018 season, and then we each track that player's progress towards a possible fam.
I think we talked about this a little bit. I like us picking one podcast.
Oh, just one for, okay, yeah. Not one each, just one. One,
because I think you know, we need to root together. We need to put the power of the podcast behind people. I know that was a big part of Tommy Pham's success, unquestionably.
Yeah, I think it gave him the sort of the extra drive that he needed.
Sure, no question, wanting to, being completely unaware of us or this idea or any of this, I think was very important for him. But yeah, I love the idea. We call it is the fam. So it's a double thing. It's the verb fam. So if somebody hits 300, 400, 500, they have fammed. We are hoping for someone to fam. But it's also the noun. I think that the 300, 400, 500 achievement is a fam. I think that's how we go with
it. I think that's right. So for the record, here are the players who fammed this year. Joey Votto, of course. Joey Votto is going to fam every year, basically.
Every year.
There's no way. Mike Trout fammed 306, 442, 629.
Now, how many times
ridiculous season.
Ridiculous. How many times has he fammed in his career?
Trout?
Yeah.
Let's find out here. Trout, in his career, he was...
I would imagine average would be the one thing that would
you know, he missed... Okay, so 2012... He missed it by one OBP point.
Oh, wow.
326, 399, 564. Okay. 2013, he did it. 323, 432, 557. Okay. 2014, he didn't. He missed it on both average and OBP.
Wow.
Oh, 2015, he missed it by one batting average point. 299, 402, 590.
You can't get closer. That is as
near. That's crazy. So he's missed two FAMs by 1 point. One's OBP and one's batting average. That is crazy.
That is crazy.
One extra hit in either season. And he has fammed every year because he did it in 2016. He did it in 2017.
What a player! What a player!
He's a monster. He's an absolute ridiculous monster.
Who else fammed in 2017?
Okay, so Aaron Judge did not. He missed it on average. Yes. Justin Turner did 322, 415, 530.
Good for you, Justin Turner.
Good for you, Justin Turner. Yeah. Well done.
Well done.
Tommy Pham, of course. There we go. Altuve did, obviously. Chris Bryant did not, missed it by five batting average points.
Wow.
Goldie did not, missed it by three batting average points.
His batting average dropped a little bit at the end of the year, I noticed.
Yeah.
I mean, it still was a sick year, by the way.
So here, just Goldie's year, just so you know, out there, if you're not watching Paul Goldschmidt play baseball, 297, 404, 563. 36 homers, 120 RBIs, 18 stolen bases. He can run the bases, this guy. And he walked 94 times. What a player. He's the best.
What a stud.
Anthony Rendon, fam.
Yes, yes.
301, 403, 533. Good for him.
Good for him. Good for him.
Freddie Freeman, playing in a brand new ballpark that has built Atlanta Cobb County residents out of hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. In a city in which no one really cares and no one's watching them play.
With a general manager who apparently plays by no rules. So
that's right. Who resigned in disgrace without, by the way, no one even noticed because no one cares about that team. Freddie Freeman, fam, 307, 403, 586.
In a very limited year, though. He did get hurt and missed much of the year.
He only had four fewer at-bats than Tommy Pham, so we can't hold that against him, by the way. And he only had 13 fewer at-bats than Justin Turner, and he had 38 more at-bats than Mike Trout. So
he actually played more than I thought. I actually thought he missed a little more than that. Yeah.
No, he had 35 doubles. He had 28 homers. He played a legit year. Here's one who came close. Buster Posey, again, very quietly for the worst team in baseball. He had 320-400, but he only slugged 462. That guy continues to just be great. That's a Hall of Fame baseball player out there in San Francisco.
Absolutely. Absolute Hall of Famer. I got a little bit of an argument with some people about that, which I don't know. I don't know what's there to argue about. Like, what doesn't he do that a Hall of Famer does? I mean, he's a great, you know, hitter. He's a great defensive player. He hits with power. He's a leader. He's all those
things.
One
World Series. He's done the boring, stupid things that nobody, that shouldn't matter, but do.
Right, right. But, I mean, it's amazing that that anybody would even think that he's not a Hall of Famer. But, anyway, yeah. Well, it is early enough in his career that I think that'll go away as he keeps doing this.
Yeah, I agree. He'll start achieving various milestones and it'll go away.
Right.
Charlie Blackmon missed by one OBP point.
Wow.
331, 399, 601.
Did you notice the other day, the great Tom Boswell, who is a baseball writer in Washington, and I mean that sincerely. Tom Boswell is a huge influence on my life and a terrific baseball writer. However, don't always agree with Tom Boswell. Tom Boswell tweeted out the other day that the real batting champion is Daniel Murphy because Charlie Blackmon, like the other 11 Rockies who have won batting
right.
titles, don't count. They just,
right.
they don't count in Colorado. That seems harsh to me. seems like it's might be entirely writing off a team that already, by the way, could not get ignored more, right? I mean, I don't think there's a team more ignored in baseball than the Rockies, right? I mean,
I think that's right, yeah.
You know, so that, I don't know, just seemed
although
seemed
the
wrong.
Braves, the Braves might be more. Ignored.
that's true. Charlie Blackmon, a fantastic year, and we're going to have to come to grips at some point with Coors Field. I mean, it is unquestionably an advantage for hitters. It's a great hitter's ballpark. We know that. But, I mean, these guys are just getting written off. Just written off.
But by the way, you know, they, because of the way Coors opened in its first like 5 or 6 years where it was just home run, home run, home run, home run forever.
Right.
People have totally missed the fact that Bank One Ballpark in Arizona is every bit the hitter's park, if not more so.
It's a crazy hitter's park.
Yeah, it's a crazy hitter's park. And those guys, I mean, there's a reason. If J.D. Martinez, as good a year as he had, if he got traded to the Phillies or something midway through the year, does he have the same second half? I don't think so. He like that. He benefited from his home ballpark in it every bit the way that Charlie Blackmon benefited from his home ballpark. I mean, you know, it's not the only great hitters stadium. These stadiums get the reputation of their first few seasons, and those reputations just stick. And obviously, Colorado's still a great hitters park, but it's not. You know, Fenway is like one of the great pitchers parks in baseball right now,
and nobody knows it. We've actually exchanged texts on this. Fenway Park has become a pure pitchers park. I mean, it really has. I mean,
it absolutely suppresses offense.
It suppresses offense. And when I was, when I was growing up, when you were growing up, Fenway was one of the best hitters parks in the game. And you know, I know part of it is the way they rebuilt it and the wind, you know, how it shifted or whatever. But that has been completely, you know, part of the reason that the Red Sox offense has been so down this year, you know, especially in pure numbers. You look at those guys, it's all Fenway. I mean, every one of those guys on the road has much, much better numbers. You know, we talk about Mookie Betts or Benintendi or Bradley or any of those guys, way better on the road than at home. That ballpark has become a pitcher's ballpark.
Yeah, they go to Baltimore and just crush the ball, and they come home and it's like 3-1 every game.
It's crazy.
All right, so here's my early suggestion for next year's FAM challenge.
Sure.
Zach Cozart.
Ooh.
Zach Cozart, a great player on an also ignored team that no one knows about. I mean, he was the starting shortstop in the for the NL in the All-Star game last year, but no one knows about him. This year's stats, check this out, 297, 385, 548. So
wow.
He was right there, and he only had 438 at-bats. He missed a chunk of the year. But he would be an early contender, I would say, for the podcast FAM challenge.
He has a chance. He has a chance next year. I mean, a lot will depend. I mean, he is, I believe, a free agent, and a lot will depend where he ends up. I mean, that ballpark, you know, speaking of good hitters' ballparks, certainly that's one. So, I'll have to think about it. I'll have to think about who we can nominate for FAMs. But we have so much to discuss about this year's postseason.
Yes.
However, before we do that, we have to do our Browns check-in.
Let's check in on the Cleveland Browns. How are they doing?
Well, I'm just going to put this to you. And this is, I think there are a lot of people nobody else is doing this, but I'm going to say a lot of people are wondering, with the Browns 0-4 and coming off of what I would have to call a disastrous performance against the Cincinnati Bengals.
Right.
Can we still count on your support as Browns fan?
No, I'm out. I'm out. I was out so fast. I didn't, again, I'm not following the NFL really.
Right.
And I was at my son had a baseball game. He had a doubleheader. And I was out pretty far away from my house at this doubleheader. And I, between the two games, one game was at like a 10 and then the other game was at 2.
Sure.
So between the two games, we went out, we got the kids some food. We came back to the field. I was like, oh, I'll check the NFL scores. And I saw what had happened to the Browns. And my immediate, instant, and complete thought was, oh, I'm out. Like, it wasn't even, I felt no guilt. I felt no sadness. I felt no shame. I don't care about anyone's response to this. I have no loyalty to the concept of trying out Browns fandom for a year. It instantly was shed from my skin like a lizard in the hot sun. I was immediately out, and I feel zero shame about
it. Zero guilt, zero shame. Yeah. I'm what am I going to say? I can't blame you for that. If I could be out, I would be out. I mean, it's just,
right.
You don't take on the Browns, right? They are thrown and dumped on your head, and you have, that's how you get them. You don't,
right? You're born into a disgusting soup of Browns fandom, and then it just remains. It sort of seeps into you, right? And then there's nothing you could do. But yeah, I mean, like that old phrase: some men are born great, and some have greatness thrust upon them. Some men have Browns fandom thrust upon them, and then other men. And women have the choice to not be Browns fans, and they always should make that choice. So what am I doing? I mean, this is insane. I immediately realized how insane it was that I would ever do this, and how like there's enough unpleasantness, I think we can all agree, in the world to where if you don't actively choose to make your life more unpleasant, then of course, why would you? You don't have to. If I don't have to do this, I'm not going to. If I had to, if there were some kind of stakes to it, if my life depended on it, or the lives of people I loved depended on it, or there were some good in the world. In other words, if there were, let's say, a crazy eccentric billionaire,
right,
said, I will give $1 billion to easing famine in West Africa if you sincerely root for the Browns for a year, of course I would do it.
Sure,
I would actively,
sure.
I would buy a vintage Ernest Biner jersey and I would buy a bunch of books on the Browns, and I would go fly to Cleveland, and I would see a game live in the dog pound or whatever. But absent that eccentric billionaire and that wager, forget it. There's no chance I'm doing this.
I'm glad it took you all of 4 weeks to determine that. And I think that the lesson that can be taken from this is that from outside the Browns bubble, you look into the Browns bubble and you go, oh, that's miserable. That's like a miserable experience being a Browns fan. They're terrible. They'll always be terrible. They'll never be good. They're stupid. They make dumb decisions. They keep looking like they're going to be smarter, and they never are smarter, and so on and so forth. But when you're in the bubble, when you're actually inside, even with one foot in to the bubble, you realize it's so much worse. It's so much worse,
yeah,
than anybody outside the bubble can fully appreciate. So I can't blame you. Look, this past week, I mean, as a someone who cannot get rid of the Browns thing, no matter what I do, last week was as dispiriting a week as I can remember. Not because the Browns lost, because that's, I mean, you get used to that. I mean, Hugh, head coach, is 1-19 now. He's 1-19. And here's the thing. He's 1-19 and nobody wants him fired.
Right. People like him. Yeah.
Yeah. People are like, you know, dude, I'm with you, man. I know what you're going through. So, you know, they're going to lose. I mean, you feel that. It's not even that they lost to a Bengals team that's really not good and was 0-3 coming in, and this was, we talked about last week, this was one of two games like in a row that they actually had like a reasonable chance of winning.
Right.
It wasn't even that they never were in the game at any point. Even all of those things aside, it was that I looked around and I went, this team has no talent, none. So everything, it's like you're staying in place. Like if you're a Minnesota Twins fan, over the last few years, it's been rough, but you've looked to yourself and you've thought, okay, well, you've got Byron Buxton coming, you got Miguel Sano coming, you got Berrios coming, you got some talent, and assuming those guys end up being pretty good, then we could take the next step, and then we could take the next step, and the next step. And then those guys came up, and there were some struggles, and you know, you never knew what was going to happen. But then eventually those guys got good, and you could see the team getting better. This team is like in perpetual awfulness. So all of the things they went into this year's draft needing, they go into next year's draft also needing. And it was also the same stuff they needed 2 years ago's draft and 3 years ago's draft. Like, nothing ever changes within the confines of the Browns. So the depressing part is not that they keep losing. The depressing part is you're going, well, now I have to listen to all of those. Well, they've got high draft picks. They've got all these things that will make no difference whatsoever, because it never, ever changes.
Yeah, it doesn't even seem to get to mediocrity. That's what's shocking. Right. In a sport where basically every team spends the same amount of money, or can spend the same amount of money, because every team is sharing a gigantic chunk of revenue, right, they never even seem to get into the 7-9 range. No. They're always in the 2-14 range, no matter what they do. It's like, it's
hard to do.
It's hard to do. That's right. It's as hard to do in some ways as it is to be, you know, the Steelers or the Patriots or the Packers, where you're 12
right.
and 4 every year.
All the time. Right.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I don't know, someone knows why, right? Someone has the answer. It's like, is it just terrible draft choice? I mean, you've written about them extensively. You follow them extensively. I don't want to really get into it too much, but is it just top to bottom mismanagement over 20 years now?
You know what it is? I mean, for a long time, it was the change. And I think that's really why, honestly, nobody really wants to see them fire the coach, fire the GM, all that, because change, every time they've gotten anything, I wouldn't even say going, I mean, anytime they've gotten any like sense of stability, at least somebody gets fired and they just change everything. Look, they got rid of their defensive coordinator last year, and they brought in Greg Williams to be defensive coordinator this year. And I thought, okay, well, you know, Greg Williams is a proven defensive coordinator. He called the worst defensive game I've ever seen against the Bengals ever. I've never seen, there was a play in that game where the Browns, it was late in the first half, and the Browns were, you know, beginning to fall apart, and they decided to blitz everybody at the Bengals quarterback, and he just threw a little screen pass, and the running back ran like 65 yards untouched,
yeah,
for a touchdown. And it was one of those plays where, like, if I was defensive coordinator, that's what would happen. Like, I'd be like, how many guys can I blitz? Can I send all those guys after the quarterback? Like, I would, oh, well, if you do that, that's what that happens. It was, you know, the chess analogy gets used often, but there is a great thing about chess where you'll, like, look over the board and you'll be thinking, okay, what? And then you'll move your queen and you've got, like, you're thinking a couple moves ahead. You're like, oh, if I do this, my queen is going to be, and you move the queen to a spot, and then the queen gets taken because you didn't see the knight there that was like going, you know, going to take it. That's what it was like. It was like, oh, they're allowed to do that. They're allowed to actually throw like a little screen pass. And I thought this team is it's disastrous. It's just disastrous. And I emailed you, I texted you immediately and said, so how's it going? And you're like, I'm out.
Yeah.
And I knew it wasn't like there was nothing I could say like, oh, hey, you promised to be in this thing for a year. However, the music is too good. The Browns check-in will continue.
Great.
But you're going to have to just kind of pretend like you care.
Or the Browns check-in every week for the rest of the season will be still out. I'm still out.
What if you win a couple? Would you like slide back in? No, would you possibly?
No, you're out. And in fact, I don't think that I would be in if they made the playoffs. Like because I have to say, like the not following
there's
the NFL
enjoyable about it, right?
Well, not following the NFL in general has made me, I think, happier on balance. Yeah. I miss it a little bit because I've followed the sport since I was a kid. And there is a certain sort of sense of like a certain loss in my life. However, I when you go online after a week of football, you know, the top 207 articles on ESPN.com are different various players who have had various injuries and are out for various numbers of weeks. And it really like once the scales fall from your eyes about what's really happening in this sport, it starts to just seem abhorrent. Like, at least it has to me. It's just like, you know, Derek Carr is out 6 weeks with a broken bone in his back. I mean, for God's sakes, what are we doing? And one of the offensive linemen on the Seahawks has a bruised heart. Did you see that one?
Yes.
He bruised his heart. I mean, it's not okay. This sport is not okay. It's really it's really terrifying what is actually what these guys' bodies go through week after week, and it really like it's not like I didn't know it before. I was just choosing to ignore it. I was choosing to be okay with it because I love the game. But now that I've sort of like taken a step back from actively watching the game, the injuries are just so awful.
Well, think about this. I mean, there's something I was thinking about watching the Browns, and you know, that's it. I literally, I've said before, and I continue to say, I will not watch another minute of football. I don't even consider the Browns football, which of course is right, because they're not. But the Browns is a purely connecting to my childhood thing. That's all it is. I don't care about the rest of the NFL and not watching it. Don't care about college football. But in watching the Browns on Sunday, this struck me. You know, there were three or four, as there always are in every game, moments where somebody's on the field, like, you know, in agony. And it's just like, oh, let's take a timeout. And they go to a commercial. And, you know, this has become so normal in our lives that, you know, you realize that they go to commercials at the end of, you know, series, at the end of quarters, when a team scores and when a guy gets hurt. Those are the four general times that they go to commercials. And I thought, that's not okay. That's not okay that they're like, you know, we have to stop games four or five times every game because guys are getting hurt on the field. Some very severely, some you're like, hey, that guy walked off. Good for him, you know. And that's not okay. We shouldn't be watching and enjoying and loving a sport where like these guys are literally dying in front of our very eyes. That doesn't seem right.
Yeah, and it starts to seem really sinister, not to get too dark here, but it starts to seem really sinister when it's like these guys get hurt and it's like, well, we'll take a short break. And then you go away to commercial, and in that time, like, and people run out and put an air cast on like a snapped ankle and cart the guy away, and you cut back to the field just as the guy's disappearing. He's like waving to the audience and giving a thumbs up. And then, like, that guy's career is over. Like, he'll never play football again. And you're just, okay, now it's second and three. And
exactly. Exactly. You didn't watch them take that little broom and just sweep him off the field. Yeah. That's fine. And the other thing that I like is when they go, his return is questionable.
His return is questionable. And then later it's like he's been downgraded to doubtful.
doubtful. Oh, he's out for the rest of the year. Actually,
he's 26 and his career's over. Yeah,
his career's over. Exactly. All right, third down and four. Let's go. You know, it's just all right. Well, we'll continue this Browns fiasco next week.
Great.
But let's talk baseball playoffs. And here's the big problem of what we're doing this. We are doing this right around noon Eastern time on Tuesday, which means we don't know. By the time you listen to this, you'll know who won that Twins-Yankees game.
Come on.
We know who's going to win. No, we know who's going to win.
We don't know who won the Twins-Yankees game.
All right, let's do a recap of the Twins-Yankees game, even though the game does not start for another 8 hours. Let's do a little recap.
Great. So in the top of the first, Severino strikes out the first two guys he faces, and the third guy pops out foul to first. Severino threw 11 pitches, and 9 of them were strikes.
11 pitches, yep.
In the bottom of the first, Santana gets Gardner on a ground out. And you're like, hey, how about that? Leadoff runner, not on board. The next four guys on the first or second pitch of the at-bat get hits. It goes double, single, single, home run. The home run is like Gregorius or someone. Someone not Aaron Judge. So it's three. It's like 3-0.
3-0 after the first inning, which was you know.
Let's say 3-0. So let's say four guys get hits, but the third one is the home run. The fourth one is a double. Okay. Santana. So it's like 3-0. Then nobody scores in the second. The Twins go down in order, or maybe they Twins. There's one walk, or there's like an error.
Twins guy gets to second on a pass ball by Sanchez.
And the announcers are saying, like, you know, that's been a problem for Sanchez this year. Pass balls, that could be a factor in the game. That won't be a factor in the game.
That will not be a factor in the game. And he will homer in the seventh, by the way.
the Twins get retired in the second. No, the Yankees don't score in the bottom of the second. Yeah, and it's like, ooh, Santana settled down. Good for him. Santana settled down. 3-0 going to the third. In the third, the leadoff runner is aboard on a clean single. And you're like, oh, look at this. The Twins making some noise. Leadoff runner on.
Making some noise.
Immediate double play and then a strikeout. By the way, Severino's thrown 29 pitches through three innings. That's the part of the key here. 29 pitches. They're just pounding the strike zone. Unafraid, utterly unafraid of any of the Twins hitters. In the bottom of the third inning, the Yankees score three more runs and knock them out of the game.
I was going to say four. Okay. I think
you say four.
Maybe they score three off of him. He gets pulled out, and then they score another run off the
ball. Okay, So Santana. So it goes like single, home run, double. So it's 6-0. They pull Santana. The next hitter is Torres or somebody. He singles to right. That run scores. It's charged to Santana. Santana gets charged with seven runs in whatever it is, two and two thirds. And it's 7-0. Now here's the key. This is the key, okay? The key now is from this point on, after three innings, it's 7-0 Yankees. The key is the Twins chip away. And when I say they chip away, I mean they score one run in the fifth and they score one run in the sixth. And you're like, well, it's 7-2 after six. It's still a safe lead, but it's 7-2. They also, in the sixth inning, they have runners at second and third and one out. So it's 7-2, second and third, one out, and you're thinking to yourself, you know, a double into the corner makes it 7-4, and then a home run makes it 7-6, and this is a whole new ball game. And that Twins bullpen, and by the time you finish that thought, they're out of the inning. David Robertson has come in and shut down, snuffed out the inning completely. So it's 7-2 after six, but you're still thinking to yourself, if you're a Twins fan or a Yankee hater, hey, you know, it's not impossible. Crazier things have happened.
Not impossible.
Right?
Five runs, absolutely.
In the bottom of the seventh. Okay, so the top of the seventh inning happens. In the middle of the seventh inning, they do the seventh inning stretch. They sing God Bless America. They sing the national anthem again. Then they sing God Bless America again because no one can be more patriotic than the Yankees. That's a rule. That's an actual Major League Baseball rule. They sing God Bless America twice and the national anthem. They sing America the Beautiful. Then an opera singer comes out and sings an aria from Don Giovanni. Then they sing Cotton Eye Joe. And the Twins pitcher, who's been ready for an hour, is just standing there awkwardly, like waiting. His arm muscles are just congealing. There's a 41-minute delay in the middle of the seventh inning.
41 minutes.
And then there's a flyover. There's a military jet flyover. And then four helicopters flyover. And a guy parachutes down. And four active Army Rangers come out onto the field. And they do the color guard again. They wave the flag.
Right.
Then they sing.
They bring the big flag.
They sing God Bless America again.
Right.
Then there's a 2.5-minute moment of silence, and it's unclear what it's even for. It's just a moment of silence, just for everything, for everything that's ever happened. There's a moment of silence. There's a 41-minute delay in the middle of the seventh inning at Yankee Stadium. In the bottom of the seventh inning, the Twins pitcher's arm is so stiff, he tops out at 71. He can't throw faster than 71 miles an hour. The Yankees score four more runs. The final blow is a Gary Sanchez home run, like you said.
Three runs, making up for his
pass ball in the second inning.
Yes.
It's 11-2. Then here's the last key. In the top of the ninth, the Twins scrape together two runs off of like a guy who wasn't even on the Yankees 25-man roster somehow, but it was 11-2.
He brought somebody in from the
Yes,
crowd.
Well, it was a guy, it was a WFAN fan listener who won a contest to pitch in a real live Yankees game. He was the 13th caller, and his prize was he got to pitch in a Yankees playoff game. And he comes out, and he gives up two runs on like a bloop single, two walks and a bloop single, and then he retires the Twins, and the final score is 11-4.
11-4. I think that's right. Well, of course, I mean, I'm glad that you did that, but by the time this happens, people will have already seen it. So we're just recapping
what
people
has happened.
Are,
yeah, I'm not. This is
what has already happened. Yeah. No, that's not a prediction at all. All right, so the Yankees then play Cleveland, and Boston plays Houston. Both, I think, very interesting series. What do you like?
All joking aside, I think Cleveland can beat the Yankees. I think their pitching is so good. They don't have – it's the first team I've ever seen, I think, maybe, that doesn't seem to have a weakness. You can't – what is the weakness
right.
on the Indians?
There's no weakness.
Their starting pitching is great. Their bullpen is great. They hit for average. They hit for power. They're patient. They play incredible defense. Their infield defense is great. Their outfield defense isn't the best I've ever seen, but it's pretty good. Austin Jackson is a maniac. I think I can't imagine. I mean, obviously, now having said that, the Yankees are going to sweep them. But
here's the thing, honestly, and this is now trying to be sort of faux analytical. That Yankees bullpen is insane. I mean, it's going to come down to Cleveland if you know trying to beat that team. Scoring early. I mean, I think the weakness of that Yankees team, and it hasn't been as big a weakness as I thought it would be, is the rotation. Obviously, they're using Severino in the game, which, by the way, was I mean, that's a little bit of a controversial move to me to use Severino. Obviously, you want to get out of that game, but on the other hand, if you're trying to win, you know, if you have bigger ideas in mind, I think maybe you go with Sonny Gray or somebody like that. In the hopes of actually you know advancing a little further, but regardless, I think their starting pitching is you know shaky enough that Cleveland could score early. I don't know who's going to score against that Yankees.
I don't know. They've got four. They've got four legitimate closers. I mean,
four legitimate closers, all throwing harder than the other guy. I mean, that to me is and look, and Cleveland does too. I mean, Cleveland has a great bullpen with great, you know, great arms out there. And their starting pitching is way better, I think. And their offense is better. I mean, they're better than the Yankees. Yeah. But you know, I mean, we saw Kansas City basically do it with a bullpen. I mean,
that's why the Yankees are scary. The Yankees are scary because their games are 5 innings long. If you're not ahead after 5 innings, the chances of you winning are very slight. By the way, I have to disagree with you on Severino. Severino's been their best pitcher by far. He's been a top 10 pitcher in the league the whole year. And
no, that's
I know,
point.
But my point is that not using him in this game, you are running the risk of being Buck Showalter, leaving
that's
Zach
true.
Britton in your bullpen and saying like, well, I was saving him for down the line when it's like, yeah, but if you don't get out of this moment first, you don't, there is no doubt.
That's right. You're right. I'm not disagreeing with that. What I'm saying is if you're the Yankees and you're going, look, this year is totally it's we're playing with house money. I mean, nobody thought this Yankees team was going to happen this fast. I realize that's tougher to say in New York, but still, if you were doing that, you were going, okay, look, we might have a little miracle on our hands here. I think what you do then is you say, okay, I know this is risky, but we think we can beat the Twins without Severino, and then I got Severino in game one. I mean, I'm not saying that they would get crucified if they lose that game, but that's to me the bold move in my mind.
It's tempting, yeah. It's definitely tempting, and it's tempting because the Yankees starters have been great in September.
That's right.
CC Sabathia somehow has been unhittable. He's just like pitching better than he can't throw a pitch faster than 90 miles an hour, and you pointed this out. He's getting some of the weakest contact of any starting pitcher in the league.
In the league? It's true.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then also Jordan Montgomery has somehow been really good. And, you know, what's his name? Tanaka's been good recently. He's had a couple good starts. The problem is like, it might be a little deceptive. They might be, they faced a bunch of mediocre teams. They faced, you know, Tampa Bay and Toronto and, you know, teams that can hit, but they weren't really playing for anything. They're kind of playing out the string in September. It's a little bit deceptive, and it gives you a false sense of security sometimes, because you're like, wow, everybody on our team is pitching great.
Right.
But everybody on your team doesn't pitch in that game. One guy pitches in that game. And
that's
so
right.
I think you just got to go with your best guy.
Yeah,
you go in descending order of goodness in the playoffs and deal with tomorrow.
I don't disagree with that as a concept. I really don't. I'm just saying it would have been a very bold move. And a very, you know, I mean, it would have been a, hey, we're going for it kind of move to say we're starting Sonny Gray, who I think is, I mean, when they made the trade for Sonny Gray, they probably thought of him as the game one starter, because Severino, as good as he was, he got better as the year went progressed.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that if you make that move, the problem is if you lose the game against Minnesota, the entire town just comes crashing down on your head, and all of the good things that you did this year are forgotten and all of that. So I get it. I'm not second guessing. I'm not. What I am saying is the bold, fascinating, exciting, interesting move would have been pitch somebody else and start Severino in game one, you know?
Yeah. And it also should be noted that, like the Indians last year, the Yankees have the ability to basically pitch a bullpen game if they needed to.
They could have started
Sonny Gray and then said, okay, if Sonny Gray is knocked around after two innings, then you go Chad Green for two innings, and you go Tommy Canley or whatever his name is, Canley, for an inning, and then Robertson, and then you have Betances. I mean, they could absolutely get nine innings out of their bullpen and by the way, combined, those guys are the if you pitch them all for an inning and a third or two innings, they're the best starter in the league.
Oh, yeah.
Chad Green, look up Chad Green's stats. It's very funny. Chad Green was a starter last year, and it was a reliever this year, and his stats last year are terrible, and his stats this year are absurd. They have four guys in their team who have like a 0.8 whip and strike out 14 guys per nine innings.
Insane.
It's absurd. So I think you're right. This is about, to me, this series is about, do the Yankee starters hold up, and do the guys that the Yankees need to mash the ball, which are Judge, Sanchez, and a little bit Gregorius or Castro, one of those middle infielders, if those guys hit, then I think the Yankees can actually steal the series, which is a terrifying thought. Obviously rooting very hard for the Indians. And then in the other series, what do you think? I have a very specific feeling about the Astros Red Sox series, but tell me what you think first.
I really do think that the Astros are the better team. I mean, I think the Astros are going to win that series, but I would say it comes down to, you know, here's the thing about that series, and we kind of just mentioned this a little bit earlier. Both of those ballparks, and nobody thought this about either one of them, both those ballparks had reputations as being big hitters' parks. Boston forever had that reputation. Houston, you know, in the early years, that, you know, Minute Maid Park thing seemed like it was a real hitter's park. They're both extreme pitcher's parks now. So I think this is a low-scoring series, which I do think helps the Red Sox quite a bit, because I think that Red Sox offense, you know, has been shaky, obviously. But... I'm still worried about that Astros rotation. I don't know that I trust any of them. You know, when it comes to any one of those guys could be great on any given day. Obviously, Keuchel can be great and was very, very good for much of the year. Peacock can be really good. McCullers, you know, struggled really late, but was so good early. I mean, any of those guys can be good, but to me, none of those guys scare me.
First of all, it was Enron Field at the beginning. Let's not forget.
Oh, that's right.
R.I.P. Enron Field. Second of all, there is exactly one way that the Red Sox can win this series,
okay,
and that's if basically Chris Sale throws a shutout in game one.
Right.
And then Drew Pomeranz throws a shutout in game two. Eduardo Rodriguez pitches a shutout in game three.
Okay.
And then Sale comes back on whatever it is, 3 or 4 days rest, and pitches a shutout in game four. The Red Sox cannot hit. They have no power at all. I sent this thing to you the other day in terms
just
of
amazing.
Yeah, it's a great stat. Was it OPS? Yeah, it was
OPS.
Team OPS, right? I think.
Yep.
Team OPS. So in Team OPS, the top 9 slots in team OPS are the 9 non-Red Sox playoff teams.
That's right.
It's like
in order.
It's in all of the, yeah, basically all 9 of the top team OPS teams are playoff teams. The Red Sox were 22nd.
Yes.
So in terms of team OPS rank, it's 1 2 the 10 playoff teams are 1 2 3 4 5 6 7 8 9 22. That's insane. They had some bad luck. They lost Eduardo Nunez late in the year. They lost Pedroia to a bunch of different middling injuries. But like they've been deeply terrible. They had 3 guys in their regular lineup all year who had an OPS plus that was over 100, which means they had 3 guys on their entire team who had a better than league average OPS. Every single other player on the team was a below average hitter. I mean, that's insane. Their cleanup hitter, Hanley Ramirez, had a negative WAR. Negative WAR. Yeah, he's their cleanup hitter. And by the way, when he wasn't hitting cleanup, you know who was hitting cleanup? Mitch Moreland hit cleanup for this team. I mean,
it probably was.
It is really crazy how little power every single player on their team had a worse offensive year than he did last year, with a couple of exceptions, those being Christian Vasquez, their backup catcher, who has become kind of their starting catcher, and Nunez, who wasn't on the team for most of the year. So, I mean, right. Even the guys who had decent years, Mookie Betts had a decent year, Benintendi had a decent year, they were both way worse, double-digit percentages worse than they were last year. So, this is about one thing only, which is, can the Red Sox starters hold down the Astros offense? And I don't think they can. I don't see any way. This is a dream matchup for the Astros, because their biggest weakness is their pitching, their starting pitching specifically, and they are facing by far and away the worst offensive team in the playoffs in either league. I don't see how the Red Sox win the series.
No, I mean, your point is right. I mean, I think that Astros offense is going to score on anybody, including, you know, and I think the Red Sox do have very, very, obviously Chris Sale's as good as it gets, and their bullpen is very good. But that Astros team can score on anybody. And yeah, I think it's an uphill. I mean, I picked the Astros. I think that series is probably a little bit one-sided, but you know, here's the thing about the Red Sox, and you know, this is I want to move it on to the National League, but this is the thing about the Red Sox. Those guys are better than their numbers, in my mind. I mean, I could be wrong, but they're, you know, when we talk, I talk a lot about this with Tom Tango, the idea of pure talent, not what your numbers say you are this year, even though that's a big cliche that you are what your numbers say, whatever. Pure talent, Mookie Betts and Bradley and Benintendi, and these guys are good hitters. And you know, their numbers have not really reflected it this year, but I think they're good hitters. And so that's, to me, the hope. The hope is that those guys, like their true selves, show up against Houston. But I think Houston is the biggest favorite in the playoffs, honestly.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
They've got to be. The yeah. 100%.
Except
for the Yankees. Except for the Yankees over the Twins.
Which already happened, and we know the Twins.
It already happened, and it was 11-4. Congratulations to the Yankees.
All right, Washington and the Cubs. Man, I'm telling you what, Washington again. Here we got another situation. I think Washington's better than the Cubs, and I think the Cubs could absolutely win that series. There's just no question about it, right?
To me, this is the most like pick'em of the series, right? Obviously. Now Scherzer's hamstring is acting up. Nobody knows if Bryce Harper is at full strength.
Right.
If Scherzer is healthy and Bryce Harper is healthy, I think you say, all right, it's the Nationals' year. They're favored. They're 65-35 favorites or something. The Cubs were a little bit inconsistent all year. They peaked in the second half. They've definitely gotten better as the year's gone on.
But that rotation is still a mess.
It's a mess. And with Harper and Scherzer healthy, I think this is a no-brainer. You pick them. But now, no Scherzer game one, you know, no Harper maybe at full strength. Now, this is a coin flip to me. I really don't know. And the Cubs also are feeling themselves a little bit. They're now like, hey, we just are winners. That's what we are. We won last year. We won the division again. Like, we fought off a bunch of teams. We fought off the Brewers. We fought off the Cardinals. They're getting used to this, and I think they're like, oh, I remember the playoffs, and that crowd is back, and they're all wearing Chicago Cubs World Champions 2016 gear, and I feel like they have a real good chance of winning, and, and it's going to be a real bummer. That Washington team has been through a lot in the postseason. they've really had bad luck, and they've played badly, and it would be a real bummer for them if they lost again. But I think it might happen.
I really think it might. I mean, again, talking about true value, because I don't think Lester Arrieta. I mean, Lester pitched kind of miserably. I mean, he kind of was a disaster down the stretch. Arrieta was way up and down all year. Hendricks and played half a year, and they had to go out and get Quintana. Lackey looks like he's at the end. I mean, there's no way that rotation should be able to hold up against that Nationals lineup. But you know, if Harper's not healthy, and you know, you're right. They play with a swagger, and yeah, I, of course, Nationals fans don't need any reason to be scared out of their minds. I mean, the way Washington sports has gone the last 15, 20 years on all across the line, all their sports, they know to panic. But there might be a reason. There might be a good reason to panic. The Dodgers will play the winner of Arizona-Colorado, which will probably be Arizona, because they're playing at home, and I think they're a little better than the Rockies. But either way, Dodgers pretty clear favorites, right? I mean, maybe against Arizona, that's a scary matchup for them.
I think they're both a little bit scary because the Dodgers did the craziest thing that any team has ever done, which is got off to a record-setting pace through like 110 games and then lost 15 out of 16. And yes. Six of those, I think, were to the Diamondbacks, and like three of them at least were to the Rockies. And I think that's got to be scaring them. But you know, the Diamondbacks are using Greinke in that game.
Right.
The Rockies are using Gray, I think, right? And they don't even really have another. They don't have one guy who scares you in the way that Greinke does.
Not yet. I like their young pitching.
They're all good. I mean, these teams are good, but they're gonna go. They're gonna waste their best pitcher in that game. Their bullpens might get beaten up a little bit depending on what happens.
I agree.
I feel like the Dodgers, I feel like the stupid narrative about Kershaw is going to end. He's too good. I think he's gotten fluky bad luck in the past. I don't see any way that the Dodgers really lose. I mean, look, both of those teams can mash the ball. They have ridiculous lineups, and so anything's possible, but the Dodgers pitching is just too good, even though it's been shaky recently. I feel like they're going to be at home. They've got, you know, they've got their lineup back. Everybody's healthy. Seager's healthy. Bellinger's healthy. Justin Turner's healthy. They've got a lot of weapons, and I feel like they're going to win that series.
I agree with you. Agree with you 100%. And I could not possibly agree more on how much I want this Kershaw doesn't pitch well in the playoffs thing to end. I'd never, ever want to hear that again. I hate that. Look, there's the only way to end it is for him to pitch well in the playoffs, right? I mean, that's, you know, this is it. I will say I was there in Dodger Stadium that day against the Cardinals, and it was one of the weirdest things I've ever seen. He was pretty much, you know, Clayton Kershaw for the first five innings or whatever it was. He gave up
six, right? Wasn't it the seventh?
Yeah, six innings. And then he gave up six of the hardest hit balls or whatever the number was in a row that I'd ever seen. I mean, he just gave up just rocket after rocket. And, you know, you remember they were talking about, did he tip his pitches or whatever? But, you know, it did happen. And his playoff numbers, much like Greg Maddux's playoff numbers, you know, you can pick at him a little bit. I want that to end. He's a great pitcher. I don't believe for one minute that there was that pressure or anything like that had anything to do with why he didn't, you know, he just, you know, great pitchers aren't always great. And I just want him to pitch fantastic. I just want that.
Also, let's all remember that he came in relief and pitched brilliantly.
Oh, he did. No, he's had good moments in the postseason too. And that,
yeah, he's had great stretches. And it's just one of those things. It's like golfers who haven't won a major. It's like Nick Mickelson isn't great because he's never won a major. It's that stupid sports thing that we do where we cherry pick tiny moments and use them as a club to beat people over that. It's so dumb. Yeah. So I love that guy, and I've come to really like this team because my jerk son betrayed me and became a fan of it. And I want them to make a real run. I want them to play in the World Series. I personally think a Dodgers Indians or Dodgers Astros World Series would be wonderful. I think both Dodgers Indians to me, it has that old, they're both like old franchises. They're like it's two really it's the two best teams in baseball all year, really. Yeah. I feel like that's what I'm rooting for, and I feel like if the Astros and Indians meet, I like the Indians easily. And if the Dodgers and, let's say, Cubs or even Nationals, when I still like the Dodgers, I feel like I'm predicting and rooting for Dodgers Indians.
All right. Well, we'll get to the next level next time. You know, after we figure out what's going on. We have a little time left to do our reader. I always call them readers. Listener questions. We have some. We have a bunch of listener questions. We have to get some music for the listener question thing. But before we do that, Mike, do you have anything on your mind?
You know, it's weird. We should get to these listener questions. We really should. But just if you'll indulge me, there's something that's been kind of rattling around my head for a little while now. Do you mind if I just get it off my chest?
You know what? Well, that's what we're here for. Let's go ahead and do that.
Great.
Let's
just do it. Real quick, before we move on, I want to take a second to tell you about the StatCast podcast. It's a new show dedicated to the analytics that drive front office decisions in the modern game. Now, it's hosted by Mike Petriello and Matt Myers. And last week, they delved into the StatCast data to find some of the most intriguing potential batter-pitcher matchups of the upcoming postseason. To hear about those secret mismatches, download the show from Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcasts by searching for StatCast StatCast Podcast, or by going to statcastpodcast.com. Anyway, well, that's what I was thinking about, and I thank you for indulging me and letting me
Here's the thing. I mean, you know, you're not going to be perfect when you're just
It's just coming out of, you know, yeah, exactly. Thank you. going to statcastpodcast.com is an absurd collection of words.
It is. That's not
statcastpodcast.com. Say that four times fast, I dare you.
StatCast podcast. No, that's too many casts in there. There's just too many casts.
Too many D's and T's and
terrible. No, it doesn't do it. All right, time for listener questions. Very exciting. We got a bunch of them, so let's try to hit as many of them as we can.
Great.
Abe Berman wants to know, and this is a good one, is batting around 9 or 10 batters in an inning?
I have a hard and fast feeling about this.
Me too. I actually do. I have a very strong feeling.
I wonder if it's the same.
Well, find out.
I would say that in order to say your team batted around, the 10th hitter has to come to the plate.
Exactly right. There's no question in my mind.
The guy who started the inning has to hit twice.
That's right. If you had a merry-go-round and it went all the way around but like stopped like just before the beginning.
Right.
Like it's not, you didn't go all the way around.
Great analogy. I would also say that batting nine hitters should be called they batted completely or something, but they didn't bat around.
That's right.
You have to come back around. The 10th guy has to hit.
It has to hit. I totally agree. That's Abe. I'm glad we could give you a decisive answer on this. It is 10 batters. You can take that to anybody you want.
That's right.
That's right. Taj Ferry. T-A-D-H-G Ferry.
Sure.
Wants to know, Cheers or Frasier?
Oh, come on.
I know. That doesn't seem... seems pretty easy.
Come on.
I mean, how low is Frasier on the list, by the way?
I mean, look, Frasier was a great show. Frasier, Kelsey Grammer's a Hall of Fame performer.
Yeah, he's
incredible.
He's a
first
ballot Hall of Famer.
Yeah, he's wonderful, and that show was incredibly well made. I mean, it's not. It's like it's you're talking about like the you're talking about like. I mean, I don't know that there's any spinoff really that's as good. That's better than the original. But in this case, I mean, Cheers is the greatest sitcom ever, in my opinion.
Well, that's the thing. Look, Cheers is Hank Aaron, and Frasier is like Jeff Bagwell. It's like he's all a famer.
Yeah.
But he's not Hank Aaron. Come on.
I like
all right. Kristen wants to know, so your wives listen to the podcast? Kristen.
That's rich.
Oh, good one, Kristen. All right. Marvelous Floyd wants to know, when your favorite team keeps doing crappy things like my Atlanta Braves, How do you separate the crap from what you like? Good question, Floyd. Floyd, by the way, your team's doing nothing that I like.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Well, they've got some good players. I mean, they do have some good players, but yeah,
they stole that franchise, literally stole hundreds of millions of dollars from the taxpayers of the of Cobb County and the state of Atlanta for no reason. Their stadium was 20 years old. Can you believe that? Think about that. Their stadium was 20 years old.
They built it for the Olympics. The Olympics were just there.
It was brand new for the Olympics in 1996, and they just were like, no, we're jamming this through. We're not having a vote. We're like, it was at, it's the most corrupt thing that any Major League Baseball team, I think, has ever done en masse for in terms of like a large scale project like this. I mean, it's so corrupt. It's insane. Like they should be punished permanently. I think there's a now, I'm going to call it right now. There's a curse on that franchise. There is an absolute, and it started with their general manager being forced to resign for violating the international signing rules. It's going to continue. Their team is going to suffer great misfortune for, let's say for 21 years, because
21 years, I think that's right.
Because it was it's the time between when the old stadium was built and the new stadium opened. That amount of time exactly will be, there is a curse on the Braves franchise and nothing good will happen to them.
By the way, we don't even know. I mean, we know that there was that he committed some various the GM committed some, you know, various sundry, you know, violations. We don't even know what they are. I mean, they're bad enough that he resigned. They didn't even tell us what they were. They were just like, yeah, he's just gone. He's just gone. Yeah,
he just gone. He left. He was like, no, yeah. I'm guilty. Goodbye.
What are you guilty of? No. I don't even want to talk about that. I don't even know. All right. Matt Kramer wants to know, question for Mike. If the Sox meet the Dodgers in the series, is any part of you rooting for your traitor son's happiness over your own? What percentage is it? Matt, it's a jerk son. It is not traitor son.
That's right. Although I think I may have referred to him as a traitor too.
No, he's also a traitor, but yeah. It's jerk son it's is jerk the correct son. Terminology.
I have to say I've thought about this for obvious reasons. You can't not think about it. And sure. In part, I've thought about it because my jerk son has been taunting me and saying, like, I hope the Red Sox meet the Dodgers in the World Series. So, yes, the answer is yes. I have had great fortune in my life, sports-wise. I've talked about this a lot. My favorite team went 86 years without winning a World Series and then won 3 in the span of 9 years, really. And my favorite football team won 5 Super Bowls, which is absurd. My favorite basketball team won an NBA championship. And I don't even care about hockey, but the hockey team from the city I root for also won a Stanley Cup. It's been absurd. It's ridiculous. It is a greater run of good fortune than any sports fan could ever dream of or hope for. It will never happen again. It's absurd. So that being said, my jerk son has chosen to root for the LA Dodgers. I have become a quasi-Dodger fan. I find a lot to like about the Dodgers. I think they're a very likable team. I am so pleased I get to watch Clayton Kershaw pitch because I believe that when all is said and done, he's going to be one of the 5 greatest, if not the greatest pitcher who ever pitched in baseball.
Totally great.
I love Justin Turner. He's really fun. I love their young guys, Seager and Bellinger. They're really fun. They've got like 5 or 6 outfielders who are all really good. So, yes, I've come to, and by the way, as I've said before, shared history of hating the Yankees. That's a huge thing, right?
Sure.
Back in Brooklyn, the team hated the Yankees and had a similarly little brother feeling about the Yankees to the Red Sox. And they're the team of Jackie Robinson, and it's impossible not to root for the team of Jackie Robinson. They are the best, the most progressive franchise in history, basically.
By far, and will always be. Jackie Robinson. Yeah. Right.
That's right. So, and by the way, when you go to the stadium, there are giant, murals of Jackie Robinson in these wonderful places, and it's great. So, yes, the answer is yes. There is a part of me that would love to see the joy it would bring my jerk son to have his favorite baseball team win a World Series. And if they won, I would not feel at all really sad. I'm, of course, rooting for my team. And if my team won, I would be happy. But if they lost, I would not be sad. And that makes me feel like, in some weird cosmic mathematical way, I would actually be rooting for the Dodgers because
that's right.
Because it's
your son's sad.
That's right. And my son's sadness at losing would be far deeper and more thorough than my happiness at winning a 4th World Series. especially in a year where the team kind of doesn't deserve it. So yes, I believe in many ways I would actually be rooting for the Dodgers. Now I wouldn't be really in my soul. I would be sad if the Red Sox lost. But yes, the answer is absolutely. I hope it doesn't come to that. I hope that I'm rooting for the Dodgers over a team I have no rooting interest in. But yes, if it came to that, I would be a pro Dodger.
Well, you know, and of course I'm rooting for your son over you. That's not even close.
Sure.
But more to the point, you mentioned this, and I think it merits a couple more seconds of discussion. The progressive history of the Dodgers is so overwhelming and so cool. I mean, obviously there's Jackie Robinson. Everybody knows about that. They also signed the first black pitcher. They were the first team to have a, you know, mostly African-American team on the field, five guys. They hired and have had ever since a Spanish-speaking announcer since like 1959, you know, which is incredible. They are just an incredibly forward-thinking, progressive organization and have been forever. And it's not that there aren't things about the Dodgers that are horrifying. There are. Of course there are. But, you know, I mean, if you're a neutral, just don't care, and you, you know, happen to, you know, appreciate all of that, the Dodgers are a pretty good team to root for, I think.
Yeah, I believe this was our main argument when we – one of our main arguments when we were trying to convince Linda Holmes.
We're trying to get Linda to choose a team.
Yes,
yeah.
is the history of the team – comparatively speaking, is pretty good. You know, it's about as good as a institutional organization in a major sports league could get. I think the Dodgers Dodgers are pretty far up there, and certainly they're at the top, and the Red Sox are at the bottom.
Well, that's the other part.
Another reason I can't be upset at my jerk son for betraying me is the Red Sox history is the most shameful, awful, and unpleasant. So I can't really force him to adopt that history of misery for himself.
We need to have Linda back on, by the way, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, we should do it before. Yes. Maybe next week. Let's try to get her back on.
Next week, we should try to get Linda back on and talk about what team she
is. If she chose a team and how it went.
Absolutely. Matthew wants to know, for both of you, what is your most memorable childhood baseball moment?
Mine's easy and boring, but go ahead with yours.
No. What is it?
Mine is I watched Game 6 of the 1986 World Series at the age of 11. In my dad's college roommate's house in Rye, New York, and was so happy because I was about to watch the Red Sox win, and then the ball went through Buckner's legs, and I cried myself to sleep. And my mom, by the way, my mom didn't care about baseball at all, but she tucked me in this bed in this strange house, and I was just weeping uncontrollably, and my mom was like, okay, this matters. Baseball matters in a way I didn't fully understand. I need to learn about baseball. And now she has become like a baseball fan. Because
wow.
Because she watched her son in trauma and decided that she needed to kind of understand it. So now she lives in the Boston area, and she and my little sister go to games a lot.
Wow. Of course, I had no such memory because Cleveland was never good enough for that. But assuming that we were talking about connection with major leagues and not our own baseball history, which I wouldn't have a great memory for that either. It's probably playing catch with Jack Brohammer.
Ooh.
Which was really cool. He was coming out, and you know, I mean, we threw the ball back like three or four times. It wasn't like a really full. It wasn't a full like Field of Dreams like catch, you know. But still, Jack Brohammer, I will always be honored and will always hold him in the highest of esteem because I had a ball and a glove, and he's like, hey, and I just threw the ball back and forth with Jack Brohammer.
That's awesome.
That was really cool.
That's better than mine.
That was really cool. yours is really depressing and sad.
Yeah, it's awful.
I mean, that's that's awful. All right, let's see here. What is your favorite Tom Petty song? Ah, there we go. That's a good one. It's very sad. Tom Petty passed away, and we're both who isn't? Who isn't a Tom Petty fan?
I don't know.
Petty's so awesome.
He was one of my all-time favorites. This really hit me hard yesterday, and continues
awful.
To. It's just so sad. I saw him he played at the Hollywood Bowl last weekend, and I saw him there.
Wow.
And it was celebrating 40 years of the Heartbreakers being together because they started in 76, 77. Very, very, very sad. And it's essentially impossible for me to answer that question. I would say, I have about 50 favorite Tom Petty songs.
Sure.
Move On is one of my favorites from the Wildflowers album. I think even though it's one of the most kind of famous songs, I think Running Down a Dream is would have to be one of my favorites. You Don't Know How It Feels is so good. I mean, there's hundreds. There's literally hundreds. There's also some more obscure songs. There's a song called Billy the Kid that I just truly love. There's a Square One is a great song. Big Weekend. The thing that makes him so kind of important to me is you can take any of his albums and randomly choose any song from any of the albums, and you'll be like, wow, that song's so good. It's really an unbelievably consistent level of songwriting over 40 years.
Well, he's the guy. I mean, obviously for me, it's Bruce also, but that's a personal feeling. I mean, there are others that wouldn't feel this way at all about Springsteen. He's a guy. I wouldn't call myself one of the top 10% Tom Petty fans. I'm probably in that second 25%. Love him, but I wouldn't, you know, I've seen him once in concert. I haven't seen him multiple times or anything like that. That said, he is probably the only artist I would say that I would literally just have his entire collection, put it on shuffle and listen. I don't need any order. There are no songs I would take out of the collection. I mean, that's how good he is. I like Walls. A little lyric from Walls number 3, Walls Circus. I love that song. I just
it's great.
Absolutely love that song. And I think, by the way, Free Fallin', even though it's been completely, you know, played out in some ways, is a fantastic song. Just a great,
it's incredible.
Great song.
That's an incredible song. One of the amazing things about him is that his voice somehow is perfect for both, like, Free Fallin' and, you know, American Girl, and and Running Down a Dream, and, you know, and Wildflowers. Like, his voice somehow was perfect for, like, gentler, softer songs, and also, like, really hard rocking songs. I don't know any other singer who could sing essentially the same way with such a variety of tempo and like, you know, hard rockiness. And still it was like, oh God, his voice sounds so great with this tune.
Well, like,
you know?
I was listening, of course I was listening, you know, yesterday to my Petty collection. And, there's the song, and I'm, you know, again, not being a huge fan. It's, what is it? It's something Outer Space from Outer Space. I can't think of the name of that song. He sounds like Dylan on it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just
there's a lot of Dylan in him.
Yeah. But I'm saying there are certain times that, like, he can, like, do Dylan, and, like, Dylan is, like, one third of his, like, repertoire. You know what I mean? It's like, he's, all right, now I sound like Dylan. Now I sound like, you know, like any of the best, you know, like the Rolling Stones. I mean, I could sound like any of the hardest rock guys. And now I sound like Tom Petty, just doing stuff that only Tom Petty can do. I mean, it's what an incredible, incredible
performer. He was the best. Very, very sad. Really bummed me out.
Yeah. Billy Pillsbury wants to know, how do you feel about Fangraphs calling Aaron Judge the least clutch player on record?
I read that piece.
You know what's funny is it was very funny. Fangraphs did. You can actually go and go to Fangraphs. They have a story showing that he has been the least clutch player on record. But here's what I'm going to say, and this is going to be controversial because obviously I don't want to say anything good about the Yankees. I think it's a bunch of baloney. I don't believe in clutch. I don't think that clutch player thing exists. I don't want to just believe in it just because it makes Aaron Judge look bad or whatever. You know, it's just kind of a quirky, weird year where he didn't particularly perform well with runners on base. I don't buy into it at all.
It's hard to imagine that a guy hit 52 home runs and wasn't clutch. I mean, because it's also this weird quirk of the way that you calculate these things, where it's like, well, if he hits a 3-run homer in the second inning, there's no need for any clutch behavior, right? Because the team is up 8-0 after 3. So, you know, I think,
I mean, it's,
I get
real.
It. It's not,
I mean,
yeah,
the numbers
it's, right. It's, they're not making it up. And by the way, they understand the math and the sort of situations here better than we do. But I think that, like, it's not, when you call a certain kind of hitting clutch, it implies that the other kind of hitting is less important. And I'm not sure it is. It feels like if you are the, you know, the 1999 Indians, and with that crazy lineup that had Tomei and Manny Ramirez and Kenny Lofton and Omar Vizquel and all those guys, Travis Fryman, you know, hitting ninth or whatever, and you scored 1,000 runs, and so you were up 11-2 after three innings. Like, I don't know, was anybody clutch in that lineup? Probably not, right? It's like, I mean, maybe they were, maybe they weren't, but there were like nine guys who were just mashing the ball. All like Will Cordero had like 20 home runs that year, so. I feel like I get it. I understand it, and maybe there's some.
Oh, and I enjoyed.
Yeah,
it.
I thought it was funny, and I liked reading anything that said that Aaron Judge wasn't like about to be the greatest baseball player of all time. I'm all in on that, but I also feel like you know, that I think that maybe if there's anything real about it to me that's repeatable or that is predictive of the future, it might be that he has a harder time picking up the ball if the guy's in the stretch or something like that, which might be
right.
Something
no,
to track.
Right, no, I think there's...
Yeah, I don't think it's worthless or meaningless or anything. I'm kind of like, yeah, all right, fine. He had 52 home runs. He's a monster. He walked 120 times. He's 25 years old. I hate him so much. I want him to go away.
He will haunt our dreams forever. All right, David wants to know, David Blackburn, there's a candy bowl in my office. How many miniature candies can I morally take at a time, and how often can I go back?
Wait, in his own office? Or like, oh, it probably in some shared common space, right?
Shared office, maybe, yeah, the office.
So we're thinking these are like the little bite-sized Snickers, bite-sized Milky Way, bite-sized Butterfinger kind of things?
That would be my gimme. They might have some hard candy in there too. But yeah, I would think that the chocolates from what he's saying.
I would say morally, depending on, first of all, this is assuming there's no actual rule posted, right? Like take one or whatever. We're assuming that.
Right.
I would say you can take two of them twice a day without thinking about it. And I think you could maybe get away with three times a day if you spread them out enough. If you want to go morning chocolate, you know, 9 o'clock chocolate, post lunch, and then, you know, 4:30
right
to 5, right at the end of the day.
I'm going to be with you. I really feel like, look, if you push it and take like, there's like a Hershey's Kiss and you take that as your third, you might be able to get away with that like every so often. You can't do that every time. But I'm thinking, generally speaking, you can come away with six pieces of candy a day.
I think you could, yeah. I mean, that's the upper limit, though, you know?
Yeah.
And by the way, I also think the key is that you can't take more than two in one moment, because I think three feels gluttonous, and it starts to feel like you are now probably on balance prohibiting other people from getting the candy they might want, right? If you're taking too much of it at a time, you need to let other people get in there when there's the full assortment of candy. So if you take, let's say you really like Snickers, and Snickers is one of four different kinds of candy in that bowl, if you're taking three Snickers, at some point you're going to start to infringe upon other people's rights to get the candy that they might want.
No, that's right.
So that's why I think two is the max you can take at any one.
Well,
at any one grab.
Now we're getting into a whole other topic, which is, even if you can take two, can you take two of the same kind? You know, I mean, really, I don't think you can. I don't think if you're going to be that gluttonous, which, you know, hey, we're saying it's okay. I don't think you can cherry pick. I think you've got to take like a mediocre, you know, candy bar to just basically make up for your gluttony. I mean, I'm just,
if there are four types of candy, I think you should personally, to be ethical about this, you should rank your favorites in order 1, 2, 3, 4. And then you should say, every time I take two pieces of candy, I'm going to take one from the 1, 2 choice and one from
there
the 3, 4
exactly.
choice. You know
that's
what I mean?
It. No, that's right. That's exactly right. Glad we could get that squared away. All right, we have time for three more. Josh wants to know, and this is specific to The Good Place, which I hope everybody is caught up. I mean, I'm not saying it's your responsibility, but don't listen to us anymore if you're not. Were Eleanor's feelings on clam chowder on NBC's Good Place really Michael's one last meaningless thing entry? So Eleanor on last week's Good Place, I can say without giving anything away, definitely took a very hard shot at clam chowder. So I think Josh would want to know, where do you stand on clam chowder?
I actually like clam chowder.
You know what?
I'm a fan. I'm a fan of New England clam chowder. I am a hater of Manhattan clam chowder.
By the way, there is no Manhattan clam chowder.
That's right. Manhattan clam chowder is fake. And by the way, I personally took a shot at Manhattan clam chowder in last year's Good Place season. Adam Scott, who played a demon, was on the PA system on a train that was about to take Kristen Bell's character to essentially hell. And he said the dining car is in the back of the train. It serves only room temperature Manhattan clam chowder, and also it's closed. That was the joke. And that was because I think Manhattan clam chowder is a crime against humanity. I like New England clam chowder a great deal. I think it's a wonderful winter meal. And that line, the two shots at New England clam chowder were taken by the writer of the episode, Megan Amram, who's a wonderful writer, very, very funny person. Follow her on Twitter. At Megan Amram, hilarious person. She took two shots at New England clam chowder. She called it a savory latte with bugs in it. And then she called it a disgusting ocean milk with dead animal croutons or something. And I didn't, I thought they were very funny, so I left them in, but those are not my feelings. I suppose they're probably hers.
That's my feeling. By the way, if you go and I could not recommend more following Megan, she lists off all of the food puns that she tried to get in. It is an astonishing piece of work.
Yes, Megan loves puns, and she in this episode that she wrote last week, which was the third episode of the season, I won't give anything away, but there's a section where you see a number of different versions of like food pun restaurants in different food genres. And when Megan first wrote the script, she loves puns. When she first wrote the script, kind of as a joke, but kind of not as a joke, she included probably, I don't know, 200 or 300
astonishing
puns. Yeah. And she, after the episode aired, you know, probably of them, I don't know, 15 of them were actually aired, which is already too many. But, you know, there was a coffee place thing. One of my favorites was Biscotti Pippin. That was a pretty good one.
My favorite was unquestionably Knish of a Rose. I mean, that's
Knish from a Rose. Yeah, that was great. So she put on Twitter like a picture, a screen grab of like the full list, and it's pretty amazing.
I've never met her. I want to desperately. She's a genius. All right. Elaine wants to ask a question, and she has an explainer because the question itself might not make a lot of sense, but she has an explainer. Does Rob Gronkowski know who Harriet Tubman is? This question is tearing my family apart. And now that makes no sense at all. Like, why would we care? It's a great question, but it makes no sense. But she then explains, and her explainer makes everything make sense. Our wedding was a few months ago, was at a women's museum. We named all tables after rad women like Harriet Tubman and Leslie Knope.
Great.
But one was Gronk table. So now we debate endlessly which of the women he's heard of. I love this.
I mean, I would need to know the full list.
The specific question is Harriet Tubman.
First things first. No, he does not know who Harriet
Tubman
is.
Not a chance.
I wouldn't say there's a mathematical certainty here,
right.
But it's as close to a mathematical certainty as you can ever achieve. And there's exactly one chance that he knows who Harry Tubman is, and that's if sometime in the last 3 days,
right,
somebody mentioned the name Harriet Tubman, and he said, "Who's Harriet Tubman?" And then they explained it to him. And now if you asked him today, he would remember. That's the only way it's possible. I believe that if you said to him, "Who's Harriet Tubman?" he would say, "I don't know. Is she hot? Can I have her number?" That would be what he would say. But if they said, "No, Harriet Tubman, the historical figure," and he said, "Who is that?" and you explained who Harriet Tubman is, there's a 5% chance he would go like, "Oh yeah, I remember reading about Harriet Tubman."
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
That's right.
Yeah, I think that there's like a 5%, there's a 1 in 20 or 1 in 25 chance that if you painstakingly walked him through the history of who Harriet Tubman was, that he would go, "Oh, I remember that from me."
Here's what I think is a mathematical certainty. You go up to Gronk and you say, "Hey, you know what? I was just thinking about historical women who made a difference in this country. Who's your favorite of those?" Harriet Tubman would not come up.
No, he would say Kesha.
That's right.
Is his favorite historical figure. Then he would say...
He would say Beyonce. Beyonce would be on his list, right?
He might say Beyonce. Then he would say Monica Lewinsky. And then he would run out of steam. Then he would. Then the next eight people he mentioned would be dudes who are on his current football team.
whose names sound like women. That would be right.
Oh, Giselle. He would say Giselle because he knows who that
is. He does know Giselle. Great question.
He would name six Kardashians.
Elaine, that's such a good question. But please don't let that become a family strife because
I don't. How is that tearing your family apart? Who's on the yes to Gronk? Gronk knows who Harriet Tubman is.
There's some Gronk supporter in that family, and just that person needs to be shouted down. No way. All right, we're gonna finish it up with Alan's excellent question. What is the most valuable cartoon character? Not the best, the most valuable. So the MVP of cartoon characters.
Like the highest war?
I guess the highest war. I guess that's what we're talking about. Well, I mean, you know, some people go by war, some people go by batting average, you know? This is how it plays out.
I mean, I don't know. I don't have a...
I've got two in my mind that immediately came up. One is Bugs Bunny. I mean, I think Bugs Bunny is an incredibly valuable cartoon character. The other is Homer Simpson. I mean, those are the two that immediately came to mind as potential MVPs among cartoon characters.
I see. I think Bugs has a very high usage rate, and I think there's a lot of misses with the hits. You know
Ooh,
what I mean?
Like I'm
thinking about value in terms of like what's his, you know. How often is his presence immediately valuable?
Ah.
I think there's still a lot of Bugs out there, man. I think in that world, I would go with Daffy Duck Bugs.
Well, you could make the argument Daffy Duck makes people around him better in a way that Bugs Bunny does not.
Yeah, I would say it's Daffy Duck. Although Homer is kind of undeniable. Yeah. I mean, he's had the longevity of like Craig Biggio's career,
right?
But the like hit rate and the value rate and the like power numbers
of Willie Mays,
you know, of Willie Mays.
His peak years are Willie Mays years, no question.
Yeah, and even the like non-peak years are still pretty reliably valuable. I think it's got to be Homer, right?
Yeah. I think Homer. I by the way, having thought about it more, I totally agree with you on the Bugs Bunny Daffy Duck. Conundrum, which I think a lot of people those were their two MVP candidates, and they were trying to decide which one to choose. And I think that's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, reader listeners, thank you for those excellent questions. Now it's time for one last meaningless thing to end this meaningless thing.
It's one last meaningless thing to end this meaningless thing. We talk about sports and we draft things we know. Like how beaches are terrible places to go. No hot fruit for Michael, nor Diet Coke for Joe. The podcast, whoa. It's one last
And I'll go first. I'll just get this out of the way. I was thinking about this the other day, and this is a very quick thought. I think in the history of American ingenuity, cell phones are the invention that most destroyed all movies that came before them. All movies that came before the cell phone are completely useless now. Every conundrum that they go through in these movies could be solved with a cell phone almost always. You know, it's like you go back to movies that they were made before cars and you're like, oh, you know, yeah. I mean, obviously if you had a car, it would be, but there's a clear understanding that this was a time before cars. It's hard to remember a time before cell phones. So every time you're like, oh my gosh, I can't, how are we going to let Bob know that this is happening? Just call him on his cell phone. So I just feel cell phones have ruined for especially for my kids who never knew a time before cell phones. They see every movie we watch. The other day we watched Double Indemnity, which is an incredible movie. And there were about three or four times where you're like, you know, if there was a cell phone here, this would not even be an issue at all. So I think cell phones have ruined movies, basically.
There's in the movie Collateral, starring Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx, it was right at the moment when cell phones were really kind of just completely saturating the world. And you could feel the strain with screenwriters trying to make sense of how to do basic plots without where everyone could contact everyone all the time. And I, in my memory, I could be wrong by this, but in my memory, at two crucial moments where Jamie Foxx just needs to call the police and say, hey, something really bad is happening and I need your help. He takes out a cell phone and there's a close up of the cell phone and it says like no signal. And there's he's like in the middle of Los Angeles. Like there's no reason. Awesome. There's absolutely no reason for it. But like you could tell like in the old days, it was like, well, he didn't have time to run to a phone booth.
Right,
but now it's like, well, he's got a cell phone. So we have to do the thing where either and I feel like the thing the screenwriters got too late is your cell phone got destroyed. Like your cell phone got the screen smashed. They got there too late. They would do it's out of batteries and we don't get a signal, but they should have done much earlier. Like in the collateral, I'm sure to that point, something could have the phone could have fallen out of Jamie Foxx's pocket and gotten stepped on, and then he doesn't have a phone anymore.
Well,
and
there's some drama with smashing of a cell phone. That's like that's a dramatic moment, right?
Right, right. They should also have got, by the way, Tom Cruise, who is a assassin in that movie, should have just taken his phone and smashed it with a hammer early on, and then you wouldn't worry about it, right? No, it's true. It's very bad. It's not great. My one last meaningless thing is a little more meaningful than it should be, in part because mostly because I'm still reeling from Tom Petty's passing away yesterday. It's really bumming me out, and I just want to encourage everyone to go to their computers and watch. If you have never seen it, watch. There's a tribute to George Harrison from a few years ago, obviously. Where Tom Petty and some other musicians, some other heartbreakers, I think Steve Winwood and a couple other guys play While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And it's wonderful and poignant now for multiple reasons. The first is that Tom Petty takes the lead vocals on it, and it's just a wonderful, it's great to hear him sing that song in tribute to his friend George Harrison. It's obviously just a great song. And now seeing it, somehow, you know, even though it's not a Tom Petty song, it really kind of gives me chills to watch him play that song. But the second thing is also poignantly and sadly, the Eric Clapton guitar solo on that song is recreated by Prince.
And that's right.
Prince walks onto the stage at the moment that the guitar solo happens, and he rips a hole in the space-time continuum with the greatest guitar solo you've ever seen. He at one point has choreographed it so that some bodyguard of his is standing on the floor below the stage, and Prince just turns around and falls backwards and is caught by his bodyguard while he's continuing to play the guitar, and then the bodyguard pushes him back up on the stage. And then at the end of it, I am not kidding, at the end of this insane solo, Prince takes his guitar off, lifts it up over his head, throws it up into the air, and it never comes down. I don't understand it. I'm sure it's obviously a trick. I'm sure gravity didn't actually stop in that moment. I'm sure the guitar came down somewhere, but when you're watching it, he throws his guitar up in the air, and it seems to ascend to heaven.
But
then, by the way, he just walks off the stage before anyone...
He's just gone.
Walks on, he rips a hole in space and time, throws his guitar up to God, and walks off the stage in about 2 minutes. And it's sad, right? We're at the time when these kind of legendary musicians are passing away, and they're no longer with us. But I'm so happy that that recording exists and that that video exists, because now with Tom Petty dying... it's now doubly poignant and wonderful at the same time. So that's my one. Let's call it a rare, meaningful thing.
I think it's a good time for it. I think it's a good time for a rare, meaningful thing to end this meaningless thing. I think that's good.
Yeah.
I think that's good. All right, Michael. Well, as always, thank you.
And thanks for having me.